right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Our guest today is Eric Margolis. Come back to the show. He's the foreign correspondent for Sun National Media in Canada. He's the author of War at the Top of the World, and his website is ericmargolis.com. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be back with you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. And now I know it's sad news for you because you had a personal acquaintanceship going back a couple of decades with Benazir Bhutto, the recently assassinated former prime minister of Pakistan.
Yeah, that's right, Scott. I've covered her career for 20 years. I've known her for that period. I uncovered some scandals in her family. She used to be very angry at me. I've been very critical of her on many occasions in the media, but in about the last decade, I developed a friendship and a very high respect for her.
Mm-hmm. And I remember when we spoke at the beginning of November that you actually maintained your journalistic detachment a bit to go ahead and report some things to us about corruption during her time as the prime minister and so forth. And you certainly didn't put her on too high of a pedestal, I didn't think, when you described her for someone who turns out was actually considered a friend.
Well, you know, friendship has to stop at some point if you're a journalist. And, you know, a lot of Pakistanis accuse me of being bewitched by Benazir and not being even harder on her. But I was hard, and her, she was engulfed by corruption scandals. Now, I don't know that any ever were directly linked to her. I don't think so. But they certainly were to her immediate family members, her husband, her father-in-law, and other relatives, and her whole entourage and administration were riddled from top to bottom with corruption. But alas, that's daily life in Pakistan.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't you go back in, I guess, 20 years or more, or wherever the story starts best, and tell us, who is this lady? What is it about her family? I read that her father had been hanged just not very far from where she was assassinated, that her family is kind of a political dynasty sort of family in Pakistan. Can you give us the background?
Yes, the Bhuttos, it's a bad analogy, but they're the Kennedys of Pakistan. Her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was, I think, may have been the first popularly elected Pakistani prime minister. And he, this is in the late 60s, early 70s, and Bhutto was her father, very flamboyant figure, but actually was one of the richest, or probably the richest landowner, feudal landowner, in Sindh province in southern Pakistan. Even though he was a feudalist, he portrayed himself as a defender of the little man and a man of the people, who had developed this populist party called the Pakistan People's Party and promised to enrich the poor. He was enormously popular. But he was also hated in other parts of the country, particularly in the most important northern province of Punjab, where most of the Pakistani army comes from. After much turmoil, and Bhutto, by the way, started the Pakistani nuclear program, he was very hated, and he was eventually overthrown in a military coup by his chief of staff, General Ziaul Haq, who I knew very well. And Haq and his associates had Bhutto hanged. And thus begins the tragic saga of the Bhutto family. Benazir was thrown into jail as a young girl. She had to go through the whole episode of her father's execution. Her family was ravaged by this, and she became one of the leading opposition figures to President Zia. She went into exile. She came back after Zia was assassinated by parties still unknown. Benazir Bhutto eventually became prime minister because she took up the mantle of her father. She inherited her father's People's Party, and she was seen as both something of a widow, even though she was a daughter, and a martyr. And she became immensely powerful in Pakistan and eventually became the first woman to be elected to lead a Muslim state, certainly the first in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. And now she was prime minister on two separate terms, right?
Yes, both times she was kicked out of office. Where the army threw her out. You know, in Pakistan, I would say the government was divided between the civilian governments, i.e. the prime minister would control about maybe a third of the government, and the military which is the main institution of Pakistan, would control the other two-thirds and make the really important decisions.
And how much of that is due to American intervention? I'm sure, you know, different foreign governments have chipped in to prop up different factions of the Pakistani government over time, but I guess at least since September 11th, this dictatorship has been our dictatorship in Pakistan.
Certainly, the U.S. I mean, this was the fault of the Pakistanis, that they could never put together a decent democratic government. You know, Pakistan was created in 1947 I always call it the Muslim Israel, because it was designed as a refuge from persecuted Muslims from India. But it was also to be a standard bearer for good government and proper morality in the Muslim world. And my God, look what's happened to it. What a mess it's turned into. The U.S. has always supported Pakistan's military governments to varying degrees. It's not responsible for them, but it certainly supported them. And it likes the Turkish model. You know, it likes, Washington's always favored having the military really running things behind the scenes in a thin facade of civilian government to give it a certain legitimacy. But to answer your question, Scott, since Musharraf seized power, he did not seize power with American help, but and the U.S. denounced him as a dictator until 9/11 came, and suddenly the U.S. needed Pakistan to launch an invasion of Afghanistan, and suddenly Musharraf was transformed by the American media from a brutal military dictator to statesman.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we need his help, right? We can't put our Marine Corps in Pakistan and Tommy Franks let all the bad guys escape. The bad guys are in his country.
Well,
I mean,
yes.
Even if we just narrow it down to Bin Laden and Zawahiri, kill those two and call the war off, fine. But those two are still there, right?
They are. The most popular man in Pakistan is Osama bin Laden. One of the most unpopular is President George Bush.
Is that really true that bin Laden is the most popular
man
in
Pakistan? Well, polls show that about 60 to 70% of Pakistanis look at bin Laden as a hero. And about 90% think that George Bush is a major villain. Ironically, General Musharraf is even less popular than George Bush in Pakistan.
Really?
Yes. But what you have, Scott, you've got the army. I have to talk about ethnic politics because it's so key to the situation. America and its NATO allies are fighting the Pashtun people. We keep calling them Taliban, but really they're the Pashtun tribe who've been disenfranchised from power. They used to be our allies in the 1980s against the Soviets. Now they're our enemies. But the Pashtun people also extends into Pakistan. Now, all the tribal territories and the borders are filled with Pashtuns. The Pakistani military, a lot of the top soldiers in Pakistan are Pashtuns, as they are in the intelligence agencies. So there's tremendous sympathy in Pakistan for the Pashtuns and amongst the ardent Muslims who see America waging a colonial war to conquer Afghanistan and keep Pakistan down. So when you say there's support, you know, there's support everywhere for Taliban, who were Pakistan's original ally, for Al-Qaeda, and for all sorts of anti-American groups, unfortunately.
Yeah, my friend Ali is from Pakistan, and he says it's basically four countries stuck inside the borders of one.
Well, that's right, Scott. There, four provinces of Pakistan, of Punjab, which is the largest, richest, dominates everything. There's Sindh, where the Bhuttos come from, which is in the south. There's Northwest Frontier, which where all the Pashtuns live, a wild and woolly place, and one of my favorites, by the way, in the whole world. And Baluchistan, way in the remote, in the deserts of the west, bordering Iran. And Baluchistan and Northwest Frontier are virtually in a state of armed insurrection now against the central government. And the Pakistani army is loath to fight its own people. But Washington the Bush administration has been paying Musharraf officially $100 million a month. I believe the real figure is at least five times that, maybe even 10 times that, has in effect rented the Pakistani army and intelligence service to fight Taliban in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and to fight insurgents in Balochistan and Northwest Frontier.
Well,
in effect, Pakistanis are saying to Musharraf, listen, you're a traitor, you've sold out your country, fight India, not your own people.
Well, and I just read a quote of Bhutto saying that I think she was asked, if you could talk to George Bush, what would you tell him? And she said to stop backing the dictatorship because he's strengthening the hand of the terrorists. And by my count, with a couple of years from now, they'll be able to march on the Capitol.
Well, yeah, she said the same thing to me and repeatedly. And I agreed with her in this sense. You know, we don't understand in the United States that the primary impetus behind what we call terrorism, which is a totally misleading term, or terrorist groups, these militant groups, whether they're Muslims or not Muslims or whatever, are motivated not by some kind of Islamic fanaticism, but by the desire to overthrow the dictatorial governments that rule so much of the Muslim world and that are in large part sustained by the United States. The U.S. and Britain and the U.S. allies are only a secondary target. The primary target are the dictators. Musharraf fits exactly in this role what bin Laden calls a tyrant. So does General Mubarak in Egypt. So does the Algerian junta. So did Sadat in Egypt and the Shah in Iran. These are the targets of the uprising in the Muslim world that we call terrorism. So, yes, we are creating a lot of the problem.
Now, this is something that's come up over and over again, is that though America has basically done exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted us to do, and I guess people talk about Iraq as our extra bonus gift to him and his policy, that people may agree with him, but it's not that people across the Muslim world have really rallied to join his cause. And it seems to me that you know, we're talking about people who, yes, they want to overthrow their governments in the region, but they virtually have no power to do so. I mean, they can kill Benazir Bhutto, but they can't replace her, right? I mean, whether we're supporting the place or not, in fact, they're probably more likely while we're backing the dictatorships rather than just letting the people of Pakistan work their differences out. If they do that, they're not likely to hire Osama to come and be their new dictator there.
No, in fact, you know, Osama's calls to Islamic militancy, and here he is preaching a kind of aggressive Islamic state, have been a complete flop.
Mm-hmm.
But he's popular because he's defying the United States. And while most of the other leaders of the Muslim world are seen by their own people as American stooges or too cowardly to raise their voices, bin Laden shouts what other people only whisper. Or tell their wives in their bedrooms late at night. And that is the essence of his popularity. I know from being a long time in Pakistan, this is the case. And we are encouraging this by supporting the dictators. We put all our eggs in the basket of General Musharraf. Now we're getting our payback for this because he's completely discredited. He's undermined. He's isolated. And we, the United States, are now left with no credible alternative candidate in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, region-wide, Pakistan and then more broadly, you know, the rest of the dictatorships in the region that we back, a dozen of them or more, I guess. If this was the AEI radio show instead of the antiwar.com radio show, could you assure me and my friends in the war party that if America stopped backing these dictatorships, that the bin Ladens of the world really wouldn't be able to overthrow them, that probably the average moderate forces of one description or another that make up the majorities of those states would keep the crazies out of power?
I think so, even though the people at the American Enterprise Institute do not. They are mirror images of bin Laden, in fact, promoting the same kind of hate, the modern form of anti-Semitism, which is Islamophobia. But what's happened in a lot of countries, not so much in Pakistan, but certainly in the Middle East, North Africa and the Middle East, is and Central Asia, is that the U.S.-backed dictatorships have crushed any signs of political opposition and legitimate centrist moderate opposition, and that's left a fringe of extremists to go underground, and Islam, where the only place they could meet in a lot of countries was in the mosque, where he could have any free speech. So we have contributed to destroying the political center, and of course that leaves the extremes. What we need to do now in the Muslim world is to encourage the regrowth of moderate political parties. I mean, when did we last hear a real moderate political party expressing its view in many of these countries? We don't, because they've been silenced.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in a way that the neocons kind of say that too, that terrorism comes from tyranny and oppression in the Middle East, but they always seem to imply that therefore we need to overthrow the governments of Iraq, Iran, and Syria, when really the terrorists, at least the ones who attack this country, are from nations that are friendly to the United States, Egypt and Saudi Arabia mostly. And
well, that's exactly
it's the
right.
Dictatorships we support that they have a problem with, not those rogue states.
Exactly. They're perverting reality, turning facts on its head. They're calling, in effect, for more dictators. You know, the Bush administration's idea of democracy is a place where the military and the secret police run the place, as I mentioned regarding Turkey, for example, behind a facade of politicians. And that's what they were trying to cobble together in Pakistan. They got Benazir Bhutto to go there. They were hoping she could make a power-sharing arrangement with Musharraf, and Musharraf would continue holding the reins of power through his connections in the army and through dispensing billions of dollars in secret U.S. aid, while Benazir Bhutto would front for the Musharraf regime and make it sort of look kosher to the outside world. But that didn't work, as we know. And it would never have worked, I don't think. She told me that she just couldn't not come to any kind of agreement with Musharraf, who she deeply distrusted. And now the U.S. policy is back to square one.
Well, a couple things there. First of all, I guess I'm reminded of the, was it Nietzsche, right? When you stare into the abyss, it stares back into you. And you know, when we go around, our government goes around with our military, our generals and officers making the deals and shaking the hands and setting up governments like this across the world, it kind of reflects back on us. It becomes, in a sense, a system where our generals are replacing our diplomats in our relations with the world, and our military, it kind of is its own empire with a life of its own here.
Oh, very much. Under the Bush administration, not just Bush administration, but primarily so, our foreign policy has become tremendously militarized. And, you know, you look, for example, at the new U.S. think tanks that have been set up in regional commands in East Africa and now in West Africa. We really set up military proconsuls around the world, and in troubled areas, they command a primary responsibility. It's they, not the State Department, that's making policy.
And they never abdicate, as Chalmers Johnson talks about in Sorrows of Empire, that once you have a base somewhere, it doesn't matter whether it was created to counter the old Soviet threat or not, the general in charge of that base is going to come up with a new reason why it needs to stay forever, no matter where. That's why we have 700 and something around the world.
That's right. You know, we have some very intelligent people in the military. A few months back, I was down in Washington briefing some senior Air Force commanders in the Pentagon on Middle East strategy and South Asia and things. So these guys impressed me very much. They're highly educated. But the problem is that at the very highest echelons, even if they know what to do, they can't get the right message across to the White House.
Well, that's certainly true. I guess the White House means the mind of Dick Cheney, basically. And
well,
I don't
yeah.
know how anybody can get through to him. Apparently his best friends of 30 and 40 years can't get through to him. So,
that's right. That was Brent Scowcroft's memorable comment that he's no longer the Dick Cheney I used to know.
Now tell me this. How reasonable are suspicions that Musharraf himself was behind this assassination, or elements within his government rather than Ayman al-Zawahiri and such, like the headlines are saying?
Well, they're very strong. Certainly, the supporters of Benazir's party are all laying blame on the Musharraf government. CNN carried an item where she had sent somebody an email saying, "Something happens to me, look at Musharraf." Now, I spoke to Benazir right after the attempt on her life in Karachi in October. And she said that she was convinced, and her security advisors were convinced that the attack, the bombing, was staged by very high officials of the Musharraf government. And she wouldn't say it was Musharraf who did it, but she said that the government, she named the people, in fact, they are a pair of brothers named the Chaudhrys, who are very, very influential in Punjab politics and who are traditional blood enemies of the Bhutto family. And in fact, one of her objectives in regaining political power was, she told Americans she wanted to bring democracy to Pakistan, but one of her major objectives was to get revenge on her family's enemies and the people who had persecuted her husband and her brothers and herself. And these were the Chaudhrys. So she said repeatedly, and to me, that these were the people responsible. I spoke to her about a week before she was killed, and she repeated the charge that it was the government working very hard to sabotage her, and she felt her personal security was in grave danger.
Hmm. So you think it's most likely, then, that it was elements within the government rather than al-Qaeda type?
Well, no, I'm giving about a 50-50 thing, because if it was done by al-Qaeda, it was such a coup for them, and such a tremendous victory for al-Qaeda, because it completely sabotaged, wrecked America's plans to bring in a pro-American regime or to sustain a pro-American regime in Pakistan. And it destroyed somebody who, it brought vengeance on somebody who a lot of Pakistanis believe was an agent of the United States and who was an apostate, a Muslim who scorned Islam, and was an immodest woman. It will have pleased so many militants that you've got to think that al-Qaeda, you know, that's why they took responsibility, whether they did it or not.
Well, you know, interestingly, in the Post this morning, there's a quote from Anthony Zinni, who was the former head of CENTCOM back under Bill Clinton, a guy who opposed the war in Iraq. And he said that in his eyes, this is all the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda attack. And he went so far as to explain why they would have done such a thing in his mind would be to try to draw us in, to bait us. Basically, this is the war against al-Qaeda writ small. They slap us in the face and try to draw us in to further bleed us dry. Do you think that that sounds about right?
Well, I have great respect for Anthony Zinni. He's a very smart officer, and he was one of the few people who dared to tell the truth after 9/11 and about Iraq, and earned the wrath of the neocon war party.
They call him a traitor.
Yeah, right, right. For telling the truth to the to his fellow Americans, it is possible. It has worked for Al Qaeda before. It provokes and goads Bush and Cheney. They react predictably. And I just saw that certain pundits on TV now calling for NATO involvement and a deeper American role in Pakistan. And I cannot think of a bigger possible disaster that could face us, having what I hope narrowly averted war with Iran, which would have been an absolutely crazy undertaking. Now there are calls for the U.S. to get more deeply involved in Pakistan. And Pakistan is just a huge and dangerous mess. It would really damage the United States beyond description.
Well, you know, there's the gigantic excuse in the sky, weapons of mass destruction. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. The United States has the responsibility to not just sit idly by, and so on and so forth like that.
You know, we've heard this. We've heard for years talks that the United States was considering some kind of preemptive strike against Pakistan to grab these nuclear weapons. Israel has been urging an attack on Pakistan to grab its nuclear weapons or destroy them. But here's the case. I've looked long and hard into this situation. I'm briefed every time I go to Pakistan by the intelligence service, so I'm on top of the story. The Pakistan's nuclear weapons are disassembled, they're in pieces, they're kept in different locations, They're heavily guarded by the military, crack units of the military and the intelligence service, ISI. There's no way that a bunch of fanatics waving scimitars are going to grab these weapons. They wouldn't know how to put them together to begin with, but more important, they have no delivery means, unless you've got a missile, and Pakistan doesn't have long-range missiles anyway. So it's not a great threat. The danger comes that if Pakistan begins to come apart at the seams and rebellion spreads in Sindh and in Northwest Frontier and Balochistan, India may be tempted to intervene, as it did in East Pakistan in 1970-71. Where the Indira Gandhi sent in the Indian Army, and the result was the United Pakistan collapsed, the Bangladesh emerged as an independent nation. The Indians might try and do it again. And if they did, this could provoke a nuclear exchange between the two.
Yeah, last time they didn't have atom bombs.
That's right.
All right, now, I'm sorry, because I think we talked about this last time. The question of the kooks inside the military. And the possibility that the military would split and that the nukes would end up in the hands of less rational types. I guess you were saying that you still thought that was a pretty small possibility.
I did. We did discuss it. And that is a minor danger. If the army does split, that could happen. But we don't see any signs of fissures in the military right now. The Pakistani military is a very, very disciplined force. And now that Musharraf is no longer commander, even though he wields great influence with the military, the military is less likely to split. What it really wants to do is step back from politics because it was getting tarred with the brush of the anger of the population against Musharraf and his ruinous policies. The army was getting it in the neck, so they've stepped back. But the question is, what will the new commander, General Kiani, do? Will he continue supporting Musharraf? Will he try and distance the army further from politics? Or will he at some point, as I fear, be forced to intervene to restore order?
That worst case scenario, or at least, you know, in the mind of a neocon, whatever the red line is for it to become worst case scenario in their eyes, we've seen already publicly, I forget if it was Robert or Frederick Kagan, and Michael O'Hanlon wrote that piece for the New York Times talking about different degrees of invasion, I guess, trying to get the Pakistanis to invite us in to seize their nukes, or if that doesn't work, invading them somehow. Do any of these scenarios seem reasonable at all to you?
Oh, absolutely. This is the height of neocon absurdity. It's almost like a death wish to get the U.S. in every kind of horrible and self-destructive situation it can. There's no way the Pakistanis are going to let the United States go in there. We shouldn't have fantasies of Chuck Norris and Delta Force somehow going in and grabbing these nukes. Pakistani military is very tough and capable. And air strikes, missile strikes perhaps, but certainly not some kind of U.S. invasion. It would be daft and it would be madness. So there's constant talk. The neocons have been trying to organize some kind of joint American, Indian, possibly Israeli operation to move against these nukes. It would be very dangerous.
I read one report this morning. Oh, in fact, it's the CBS headline at the top of antiwar.com. And there they quote Defense Department officials as saying that the U.S. is right now, quote unquote, physically watching Pakistan's nukes. What does that mean? From space? Or they actually have a corporal standing there with a rifle?
Oh, from space for sure. They're possibly flying recon drones over Pakistani airspace from Afghanistan. But the CIA and the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, do not know exactly where these nukes are. I mean, they suspect where some are. The nukes are, I understand, shielded, so they're not picked up by radiation detectors from space. They cannot be sure if they make an attack that they're going to find the locations.
Let me see here. Oh, I want to ask you about this guy, Sharif. He's the other Democrat, the other former prime minister who's come back to Pakistan from exile, and I guess all eyes are on him now that Bhutto has been killed.
That's right, Scott. You're quite right in that. He, Nawaz, was a protege of General Ziaul Haq. And I've interviewed him extensively, and I was underwhelmed by him, as are many Pakistanis. He was a former industrialist, and he has no charisma. He and his brother were very powerful, but they were hardly inspirational leaders for Pakistan. But he's the last man left standing.
And now he was from a different party than her, is that it?
That's right. He was the leader of the Muslim League, and which was General Zia's party as well. And when he was kicked out of Pakistan, Musharraf overthrew Nawaz in 1999.
Oh.
Nawaz had to flee into exile. Nawaz's party split and into two factions, one of which remained with Nawaz, and one of which aligned itself with Musharraf, earning the name of the... It's the Muslim League Musharraf, and it's called the King's Party. It has very little legitimacy. It's just made up of opportunists and carpetbaggers and sycophants who have grown rich supporting the current regime. So Nawaz is in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis put a lot of pressure on Pakistan because they're a major financial backer of Pakistan to allow Nawaz to come in. It was an interest. It was a undertaking done apart from the United States. Washington wasn't very happy that Nawaz came back because they wanted him to stay in exile and make sure that Benazir got elected. But anyway, Nawaz returned. But then what Musharraf did was he cooked up this law after having fired all the judges from the Supreme Court and putting his own yes men in power. Nawaz got the Supreme Court to rule that, to indict Nawaz on various criminal counts, and to rule that because he was indicted, he could not run in the upcoming elections. So Nawaz was effectively excluded, not his party, but Nawaz personally was excluded from the election. That would have left Musharraf, Benazir, and some Islamic parties who controlled between 10% and 20% of the popular vote. But Nawaz is still there, and he's the major Democratic politician, and the United States has been very hostile to him all along. It turned its back on him and never supported him, even though he was a legitimate leader. And now it continues to try and marginalize him and sabotage him at every step.
So really, he's in no position to kind of take up the space left by Benazir Bhutto.
Well, his party is not going to be able to take control of Bhutto's followers. This is the problem. They're from very different backgrounds, and Nawaz is much more associated with the Islamists in Pakistan. Hence, Washington's hostility to him.
Yeah. And now, what about her party? Is there anybody to take her place within her party?
There's nobody of any stature. She was a great oak under which no small trees flourished, so that she brooked no competition in the party, that's for sure. She was a queen, and she has some senior party members now, but they are really minor figures, many of them yes men, and we just don't know who's going to emerge from the party. But right now, I don't see anybody who's very strong. That doesn't mean somebody won't eventually emerge. Pakistanis are very intelligent, capable people. Somebody has to come along, but there's nobody on the radar scope now.
Hmm. All right, well, so if you could be Stephen Hadley for a day, what's your ultimate advice to American policymakers? What's the right tactic for America to take in regards to dealing with these countries in South Asia, Pakistan particularly?
You know, our current problems in Pakistan now, which is turning into the biggest foreign policy mess that we're going to face next year, began with the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Americans will not face this fact, but they started the ball rolling with that. And by putting a gun to Pakistan's head and forcing the Pakistan's government to fight against its own people, that has caused a lot of the current tension and violence in Pakistan. My solution is to start by making peace in Afghanistan, bringing the Pashtun people into the political process. It's going to happen one day. It's inevitable. It's unavoidable. Washington just won't do it. You know, it keeps demonizing Taliban instead of realistically negotiating with them. And the U.S. should be discreetly supporting Nawaz Sharif as a Democratic politician, Imran Khan, who's another political leader, and the Islamists, the moderate Islamist parties in Pakistan, as shoring up parties with popular political support. We should take a much lower profile in Pakistan, stop acting like a military proconsul, get our military bases out of Pakistan, and try and be seen as a friend of Pakistan, as we used to be in past decades, rather than as an imperial power.
Should we even be backing any parties there at all? Would it not be better to just take hands off for a little while and let things shake out?
Yes, it would be. But if we have to do something, mm-hmm. After the damage we've caused by backing this ugly dictatorship in Pakistan and funding it, and encouraging it to kidnap up to 1,000 of its people and make them disappear and arrest thousands more. After doing this, the least that we can do, if we have to do something, is give some financial support to the centrist parties there and give them our blessing and stop opposing them. Right now we're in an opposition mm-hmm. thing where, you know, it reminds me what the Soviets did in Eastern Europe as more moderate democratic parties started to emerge. The Soviets bitterly opposed them. We're doing the same thing in Pakistan.
Oh, well, I always love good analogies of American policy to the old Soviet days. Now, when you talk about Afghanistan, in fact, there's a headline today from the Telegraph in England. U.S. backs talks with Taliban as envoys expelled. And now we've heard, you know, stories here and there that the Americans are willing to talk with the Taliban. I don't know whether this is, you know, a real effort to do so now, but, the Taliban are not Al-Qaeda, right? I mean, we're talking about there's quite a big difference between the Pashtun tribesmen of Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Arab Afghan army of couldn't be more than a few hundred guys left, up there. With bin Laden and Zawahiri.
That's correct.
The question is, could these people be convinced, if we were to really deal with them, could they be convinced to just turn over the Arab Afghans to us? And what I'm looking for here, Eric, is an end to this war. I'm tired of having bin Laden on the run forever and ever and more excuses to invade, you know, whoever's next after Somalia now in the name of Osama bin Laden. I want him and Zawahiri in court in Virginia or their throats cut, and I want this war to end tomorrow, yesterday.
Well, I think that's what we should be looking for. But, you know, we're fighting in a sense. We've no business fighting the Pashtun people. The Taliban come from the Pashtun people. They are part of the Pashtun people. Not all Pashtuns are Taliban, obviously. But we are fighting a tribal war now. This is not just Taliban, because there's Taliban. There are other tribal levies there who are fighting us. They're old Mujahideen commanders like Jalaluddin Haqqani. There's my old pal Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. This is not just Taliban terrorists. Taliban, by the way, had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks against the United States. They didn't know about them. They were shocked by them. And for us to keep fighting, you know, the Pashtun are 50% of the population of Afghanistan. You can never have peace or stability in that country without dealing with the Pashtun. And what we've done is we've aligned ourselves with the blood enemies of the Pashtun, who are the Tajiks and the Uzbeks. I know this is confusing stuff, but Soviets did the same thing. When they invaded, they joined the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and fought against the Pashtuns, who we were aligned with.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be no peace in Afghanistan until we resolve this problem with the Pashtuns and bring them into the political process.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. It brings to mind, I saw this thing. There's a new movie coming out, I guess, about Charlie Wilson's war, which I won't see. But I did see a thing on the History Channel where they did, you know, the true story of Charlie Wilson's war. And it was just amazing to see an hour-long, you know, more or less History Channel-style documentary about this with virtually no parallels drawn, no consequences extrapolated. At the end, they said, well, the lesson is that 9/11 wouldn't have happened if we had replaced the Russians and occupied Afghanistan after we drove them out. Then everything would have been fine, and so we learned that lesson. But other than that, it's not our fault that September 11th happened and that these Mujahideen warriors have a following around the world.
I have not seen the movie yet, but I know almost everybody involved in that book and the characters in the movie. I was there with them. I was drumming up support for the Afghan Mujahideen. I was with Charlie Wilson, the legendary Charles Fawcett, General Wardock, anyway, all these characters. And it's a mistaken impression that they won the war. They did not win the war. The 20-millimeter Oerlikon guns that Charlie Wilson got proved to be useless. They were too heavy to move around. And while he did help get some Stingers, which played a big role, you can thank the CIA for that more than anybody else. And the primary victor in the war was the Pakistani army and Pakistani intelligence. They bore the brunt of the war, not Charlie Wilson. This is giving us sort of a cartoon version of history.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we should have invaded, occupied Afghanistan after the war shows how little the authors of this work understand or know anything about Afghanistan. Ironically, we have replaced the Soviets in Afghanistan as an occupying imperial power, and we've replaced the Soviets in the enmity of many Afghans.
Now, it's interesting, you know, I didn't realize that you actually had helped drum up support for the Mujahideen and so forth. I'm reminded of an interview with Zbigniew Brzezinski before September 11th, where he was asked whether he regretted backing the Mujahideen warriors in the fact that now there's, you know, this threat of these global jihadist types. And Brzezinski said, what's more important, the fall of the liberation of Eastern Europe or some stirred up Muslims? And seem to think that whatever the price is, it's worth it. Now, again, that was before September 11th. His view of that may have changed now. How do you feel about that?
I agree with Brzezinski, definitely. It was one of the smartest moves that the U.S. made to oppose the Soviet Union. And it was, and their defeat in Afghanistan was the major reason for the collapse of the Soviet Empire, which was a very good thing. Brzezinski also claims to have started the war by sending over guerrillas from Pakistan into Afghanistan before 1979 to goad the Soviets into invading.
Mm-hmm.
I have never been able to establish whether this was true or not. But the idea that's been circulated, and particularly by the neocons, that by supporting the Afghan Mujahideen, who we used to call freedom fighters, the same Pashtuns we now call Islamic terrorists used to be called freedom fighters.
Yeah, they even made Rambo 3 about them.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that somehow by supporting them, we created 9/11 is just not true. The seeds of Islamic opposition were there, but the struggle in Afghanistan had nothing to do with the later development of 9/11. I was in Afghanistan with Sheikh Abdullah Azam, who was the mentor and teacher of Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. And he said to me back in 1986, I remember vividly, he said, once we have liberated Afghanistan, we will go on to liberate Saudi Arabia from American control. This was the objective of a lot of the Mujahideen, kick Western influence out of the Middle East. But there was never any talk about attacking the United States, which at the time was still adored by most people in the Muslim world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see how, you know, you could argue that it wasn't a direct consequence. You know, there was the time lag in there and different factional fights and so forth. But, I mean, it is the case, right, that Osama bin Laden got to call himself a hero because of one battle somewhere or something. This is where he made his name and was able to establish himself as a leader because of that war.
That's quite true. But, you know, I think that violence against the West, attempts to kick the Americans out of Saudi Arabia, would have come even if Afghanistan had never occurred. Let's remember, most of the hijackers of the planes on 9/11 were young Saudis,
mm-hmm.
who were far too young to have ever fought in that war. The spirit, the anti-American spirit, was alive and growing in the Middle East, but it would have come, and it's going to continue along unless we change our policies.
Well, I really appreciate your insight on this and staying over a little extra time. Everybody, Eric Margolis, it's ericmargolis.com to read all he writes. He's the foreign correspondent for Sun National Media, also for the American Conservative Magazine, and he's the author of War at the Top of the World. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Scott. It's been a pleasure.